Welcome to our audiocast, Dispelling the Myth, the Truth About the Intersection Between Violence and Mental Health,
which is part of the American Hospital Association's ongoing series of discussions with healthcare leaders and others about combating violence in our communities, our hospitals, and our health systems. I am Rebecca Chickie, AHA's Member Relations Director of Behavioral Health. And in this audiocast, we are talking with Jeffrey W. Swanson, Ph.D., Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and Center for Child and Family Policy Faculty Fellow in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University School of Medicine in Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Swanson is a medical sociologist. He received his Ph.D. from Yale in 1985, and has expertise in psychiatric epidemiology, mental health services effectiveness, and mental health law and policy studies. He is the author or co-author of over 200 research publications on topics including violence and severe mental illness, the impact of involuntary outpatient commitment law, and psychiatric advance directives. Joining me now is Dr. Swanson. Welcome, and thanks for talking with me. Could you first describe for us your background and how you became interested in the research you do?
Sure, and thank you for inviting me. I have an academic background in the sociology of mental health, mental illness, and in psychiatric epidemiology, which means that one uses the theories and the research methods in social science and public health to study and to explain how mental illnesses occur in human populations rather than focusing on the individual case. So we look at, you know, how society defines and labels and responds to and manages mental illnesses through various kinds of institutions and organizations and structures. My work with my colleagues is focused mainly on people with serious disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and major depression that impair the brain's ability to think and reason and perceive reality or regulate mood and behavior. And a social scientist can study patterns in how these disorders occur and affect vulnerable individuals over the life course in relation to social determinants and structures and factors in the social environment, like poverty or childhood maltreatment, for example, lack of access to health care, housing, as well as social consequences and related problems like homelessness and incarceration, and occasional but important complications such as violent behavior and suicide. And I got involved early in my career in helping a big state systematically assess the need for mental health services in every county in that state. And if you think about it, when people are found to be at heightened risk of violence or suicide, harming others or themselves, in addition to having an underlying psychiatric disorder, that puts them at a higher priority of need for intervention than other people. And not only higher priority for service, but maybe different kinds of services, more intensive interventions, for example, that are designed to protect people from harming themselves or others. So this really got me to think carefully about these additional problems like violence and self-harm, how they're connected to mental illness in complex ways, maybe how they're not related, what we know about that scientifically, what we don't know, and maybe what we think we know sometimes that ain't so. You know, how to measure them accurately and what we could do to help solve these public health problems once we know more what they look like in populations, and hopefully in the long run to lessen the vast amount of human suffering that they cause.
So is it safe to say that one research area you're passionate about is the intersection of mental illness and violence? And if so, can you share the results of your research in this area?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. Interpersonal violent behavior as well as self-injury or suicide, these are rare complications of mental illness, as I've mentioned, and they're caused by a number of other factors as well. But they're very costly, and they're devastating in human terms. I'm a sociologist, but I work in a psychiatry department, and my colleagues and I work together in our research to build evidence for the effectiveness of interventions and policies and laws that hopefully will make life better for people with serious disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder that I've mentioned, which are often combined with substance abuse and other problems, and sometimes result in criminal justice involvement and other bad outcomes that we might be able to avoid. So what have we found in our research? Well, in our early research on the prevalence of interpersonal violent behavior in people with psychiatric diagnoses, we found several things, some of which are surprising. One is, this is very important, that most people with serious mental illnesses, the vast majority actually, are not violent, and they never will be. It's only about 7% who engage in any acts of violence, and these could be minor to serious acts, from pushing and shoving and slapping somebody all the way to using a weapon, doing something more serious. Only 7% will do that in a year. 93% will not. So when people with mental illnesses do commit crimes, they're actually less likely to use guns in crime, according to some new research. Now, when a gun is used, let's say in a suicide attempt, it's almost always fatal, and it can be very dangerous, you know, in any kind of an altercation. It can take an act of ordinary aggression and make it into a fatal tragedy. But about two-thirds of the gun fatalities in this country are suicides. That's important to know. Most people don't realize that. It's important because the facts are different from what many people believe. There is this myth out there that people with mental illnesses are all dangerous towards other people and to be feared, and there's research showing that 60% of adults in this country believe that people with schizophrenia are likely or very likely to be violent. And that's not so surprising if you look at how people with schizophrenia are portrayed in the media. You know, if you came from a distant planet, you learned everything you knew about schizophrenia by watching television, you'd think every person with this disease was some kind of a homicidal monster. Why is that important? Well, it's important because it's wrong. It's a harmful stereotype. But it's also important because people act on the basis of what they perceive to be true. So if you believe this, you might do what? You might reject people with mental illnesses. You might seek distance from them and support public policies that restrict their liberties unnecessarily. In the end, you might discriminate against people with mental illnesses in the distribution of the rights and benefits and opportunities in our society. And this just increases stigma of mental illness. It makes it more difficult for people to receive the support they need to recover. It might even drive people away from seeking care and make people with mental health problems afraid to disclose their concerns and their symptoms to a health professional who could help. And actually, with respect to the violence myth, I should say, mental illness is much more strongly related to self-harm than it is to interpersonal violence, and people with serious mental illnesses are much more likely to be victims of crime than perpetrators. One study shows 25% of people with serious mental illnesses are victims of some kind of crime. So at the same time, we have to say people with serious mental illnesses are, in relative terms, about three times more likely to engage in violence than those without mental illness. So there's a modest relationship. Still, of all the violence out there in society, only about 4% is attributable to mental illness as a unique risk factor. So if we cured mental illness today, which would be wonderful, our problem with violence in society would go down by about 4%, and 96% of it would still be there. So mental illness is important, and we definitely need better mental health care in the United States, but it's not the place you'd start if you wanted to address violence. So finally, we've learned that violence is caused by many other things interacting with each other, not just one factor. A part of it is demographic. Being young and being male is associated with violent behavior. Part of it has to do with a social environment, such as poverty and all the problems and sort of pathologies that go with that at the community level. Childhood victimization, maltreatment. I mean, if, you know, kids are growing up at a time when they should be establishing an intact personality and they're being beaten up and victimized by the adults that they should trust, that's bad. It portends bad things as they grow up. Substance abuse plays a big role in violent behavior, both in terms of its pharmacological effect. It can disinhibit aggression. It can interact with psychiatric symptoms like excessive threat perception. And it can expose people to risky social environments such as participating in illegal drug markets, just exposure to violence, living in a violent, crime-ridden neighborhood. It's almost like a contagious disease. So these are things we've learned about the complexity of the problem, which is important if we're going to think about effective solutions. It's like a big jigsaw puzzle, and I could talk about some of those pieces in that puzzle.
Share with us other research in the topic area.
So we've done a number of studies in our group evaluating the effectiveness of legal and policy tools. We sort of work at the intersection of law and psychiatry and public health law research, shall we say, for improving access to effective mental health treatment for people with psychiatric disorders, serious mental illnesses. Examples of this would include court-ordered outpatient treatment, where the civil court is used to mandate people to participate in treatment in the community, and there's this treatment plan inside a court order. Other kinds of leverage that actually get people to comply with treatment and to help systems of care to prioritize and to serve people who have intensive needs. Another is psychiatric advance directives. This is a legal tool where people fill out legal documents to express their preferences and direct their own care during a future incapacitating mental health crisis. And we found that these can be effective tools if they're targeted to the right people, but they have to be much more broadly implemented. And I would say implemented in conjunction with reinvesting in mental health care in the United States in a way that's going to improve the capacity of public behavioral health systems to provide high-quality outpatient treatment, inpatient treatment when it's needed, and services that are needed for people with serious mental illnesses. So the systems that we have are often fragmented and overburdened and under-resourced, and we have treatments that don't work very well for some people. So we need better mental health treatments. We need better ways of delivering them to people, and frankly, more public resources for doing that, and I think also more resources for doing research in mental health services and policy, so we know how to do this in a way that's effective and also cost-beneficial. But I'd like to tell you about our newest research study, which evaluates an innovative type of state law designed to temporarily remove firearms from dangerous people, people who have behavioral indicators of risk, not about mental illness categorically. So it's a tool to separate firearms from people at high risk of harming themselves or others at a time of high risk. Now, we know that guns can make a difference, as I've said, between ordinary aggressive behavior and deadly violence. It can make the difference between an impulsive act of self-harm and a completed suicide that's going to be a permanent tragic loss to families that just ripples through communities. We know that there are lots of people at high risk who are behaving in obviously dangerous ways, whether or not they have mental illness, and who legally own or have access to firearms. Now, they don't necessarily have any record that would put them in a category of being legally prohibited from guns, like a history of a felony conviction or involuntary civil commitment. We know that even if some risky people are prohibited from purchasing a new gun, say from a licensed dealer, there are a lot of guns out there, and people have existing access to guns. So this is a legal tool I'm talking about. It's known most commonly as a gun violence restraining order. It's kind of built on the platform of an order of protection, and it involves a civil court order with a public safety purpose. It doesn't convey any kind of criminal record involvement. It's about demonstrable risk. It could be like, you know, we're worried about granddad who's bereaved and he's drinking heavily, or he's depressed and he has these guns and he owns them legally, and what are we going to do about that? Well, in Connecticut and Indiana and California and in Washington State, you can actually get law enforcement to look at this and prepare a legal affidavit, get a court order to separate those guns from your loved one for a period of time. It puts this tool in the hands of family members. And there's legal due process involved. A court hearing is involved. It's available, as I said, in 4 states, but many other states are considering it. And our new research study in Connecticut, which is forthcoming in the Journal of Law and Contemporary Problems, finds that for every 10 to 20 gun removal actions, one life is saved, one suicide is prevented. But with respect to gun violence, you know, we have 85 or 90 people every single day who die as a result of a gunshot. And I think that's unacceptable. And I'm working on that from a public health point of view. A small part of it is about mental illness, unless we talk about suicide. And I hope that, that one day we will get there.
Dr. Swanson, thank you so much. Do you have anything that you'd also like to add, work that hospitals and health systems might be able to do to help diminish the myth that mental illness is often the root cause of violence?
Well, I think there are a number of things that health systems are in a position to do. I'll just sort of say this in general terms. I think one is education. I mean, there's a, you know, there's the moral and cultural authority that doctors and healthcare institutions have that they can use. It gives them a powerful voice to get this message out, either directly or indirectly by supporting the mission of mental health consumer advocacy organizations, family groups, partnering with these groups in various kinds of education. I think another thing they can do is continue to engage seriously in incorporating mental health care and prevention into primary care so these illnesses are treated like other chronic health problems, you know, with true parity and not like there's some special, strange, weird thing that you have to be embarrassed of. Mental health exceptionalism is deeply rooted historically, philosophically, you know, in mind-body dualism, that mind and body are separated. We need to get over that. We need to realize that minds and bodies are intimately connected. This problem, you know, with this bifurcation, it's reinforced every day in the structures and the organization and the financing of care. Health systems need to find ways to break down those walls, those barriers, and treat people with mental illnesses like people, like other patients. I think another way is by fostering patient-centered care, doing things to empower individuals with mental illnesses as persons with autonomy, rights to make their own decisions about health care, to manage their illnesses and recovery when they're able to do so, and to prepare for periods of incapacity with, say, a legal tool such as an advance directive. I think psychiatric advance directives are a great way for health systems to work together with patients and family members in shared decision-making and in ways that empower and respect people with mental illnesses. I think it's going to reduce stigma as well over the long run. So those are just some things that come to mind.
Thank you, Dr. Swanson, first for sharing with us the results of the research and the importance that all of us need to stand up for the reality that mental illness is not a big part of the problem of gun violence in the United States. Based on the evidence that you share, it's clear that the large majority of people with mental disorders don't engage in violence against others, and that most violent behavior is due to factors other than mental illness. I believe that many of the hospitals and health systems that will listen to this will find the data and research you've shared to be important resources for their own organization's efforts in the communities that they serve. And thanks to our listeners. Dr. Swanson has graciously provided a couple of articles that support and dive deeper into the research that he has shared with us today. For access to those, along with other audiocasts in our ongoing series related to combating violence in our communities and our hospitals, please be sure to check out AHA's dedicated Hospitals Against Violence webpage at www.aha.org/HAV.